Money Show with Bruce Whitfield, your number one news and talk station.
Welcome to The Money Show, brought to you by Old Mutual. Do great things. I love my job for many reasons, but particularly because you get to see extraordinary things. And today, Eskom, state-owned enterprise, announcing it is suing for defamation, not only the Democratic Alliance, but also its Shadow Minister of Public Enterprises, Natasha Mazzoni. We'll talk to Natasha Mazzoni, plus independent legal consultant specializing in media law, Ben Winks, standing by to talk about the issues around what is going on with Eskom and suing for defamation. We'll talk about heists at the airport. We'll touch on the fact that the Kruger Rand is 50 and it's got an illustrious history and is the world's most collected gold coin. Colin Cullis with Business Unusual and our shapeshifter this evening. I'm wearing a suit because it is Her Majesty Ina Parman coming to join us in studio this evening. Looking forward to that on tonight's Money Show.
The Money Show.
Your number one news and talk station.
Plenty of mystery also what was stolen in that audacious O.R. Tambo International heist last night. We'll see what information we can get through on that. Well, news breaking this afternoon that Eskom, the state-owned electricity provider, is planning to sue the DA, Shadow Minister of Public Enterprises, plus the Democratic Alliance over allegations of fraud and corruption within Eskom. Natasha Mazzoni is the person who made those allegations. Are you apologizing, Natasha? Are you backing down? Are you saying sorry to Matsela Koko and to Eskom for insinuating and for saying that there was fraud at the highest level of the organization?
Bruce, I'm certainly not going to apologize and I'm certainly not backing down. I don't scare easily. I've always been one to stand up to bullies and I intend to carry on with that. And I have, together with the Democratic Alliance, filed my intention to defend.
What is at issue here? Here is Eskom, whom we invited Matsela Koko onto the show tonight as well. He and his spokesman, interestingly, have declined to comment on the charges that they are pressing against you. What is the basis of your defence?
Well, the basis of our defence, I don't want to go too much into it, obviously, Bruce, because it is with our attorneys at present. But, you know, it is my job. I'm constitutionally obliged to hold state-owned entities accountable. It's my job to request documents and to make comments on documents that become public knowledge. It's my job to make sure that I'm the voice of South Africans who voted me into my position as MP, and I'm certainly not going to ever back down from doing that. And certainly when there are reports such as the Denton report that get sent to me in such a redacted version that it's just simply laughable, I'm certainly not going to keep quiet. And if Eskom thinks that by suing me they're going to stop me from doing my job, they have another thing coming.
I mean, there's parliamentary privilege. You could have raised these issues in Parliament. You raised them and published these allegations on the DA website, which potentially makes you as a private citizen vulnerable if a court decides that the statements you made asserting that there was fraud and corruption at the highest levels of Eskom involving the acting chief executive, Matsela Koko, that you could be sued in your personal capacity.
Bruce, defamation is a very interesting part of our law, and you know there's various ways of looking at it, various ways of interpreting what is defamation, and also you know one looks at the various defences of it. But you know if one looks at whether a comment is fair and whether it's in the public interest, of course my job as an MP is to expose things, and I do so regularly. And, you know, I think the fact that I do so in a public forum gives you an indication that I know what I'm talking about. I certainly wouldn't make a comment that's unfounded. And it means that I am able to back up and substantiate my allegations.
Natasha Mazzoni, thank you. Shadow Minister of Public Enterprises at the Democratic Alliance will defend herself when facing charges of defamation by Eskom and its acting chief executive. Now, this is interesting. I was under the impression that a state-owned enterprise, a public company, couldn't sue for defamation. Ben Winks is independent legal consultant and specializing in media law. Have you ever seen anything like this before, Ben?
Good evening, Bruce. Thanks for having me. Interestingly enough, I have. It's even though, as you rightly say, it's not competent for an organ of state to institute a defamation.
No, hold on a second. Let's be very clear on the meaning of the word competent. You're using it in a legal context, and our listeners may understand that to mean something else. What do you mean by it's not competent?
Yes. So the position in our law, not only under our constitution, but even as far back as the 1940s, the position in our law has clearly been that an organ of state, although it has a reputation as a matter of fact, and yes, that reputation can be injured, it has no right in law to institute an action against a citizen to protect or restore that reputation. So the state cannot sue for defamation. But we do see it happening. SARS instituted the defamation action against the former spokesman Adrian Mackay a couple of years ago. There are, you know, other examples where organs of state have tried to assert essentially private rights that, you know, only non-state entities can have, but nevertheless they've instituted actions to protect reputation, privacy, etc., which they're legally not permitted to do.
So this is something of a red herring of a court case then?
Well, it's, I mean, the position, I haven't seen the summons, but it may be, as in the SARS case, that the action is brought jointly by ESCOM, the institution, and the official at ESCOM who claims to have been maligned in some way.
Now, who in this case, it's Matsela Koko who's saying, hold on a second, you've insulted my integrity, you're accusing me of being corrupt, and I am not that kind of person. Is it the job of the state-owned enterprise to sue and to carry the costs on behalf of the acting chief executive, or should the acting chief executive be carrying this case in their own name? Because there is potential for chaos for anybody in the public sector taking umbrage to any criticism in the public domain if the costs are going to be picked up by the company they work for.
Certainly, and I'm very glad you asked that. It's a very important issue in our constitutional dispensation that state funds are used for the kind of litigation that they shouldn't be. I'm going to do something very dry, if you'll forgive me. I'm actually going to quote from this 1946 appellate division judgment that established in our law that the state can't sue, because the language is quite important. What the court said was that it would involve a serious interference with the free expression of opinion if the wealth of the state derived from the state's subjects could be used to launch against those subjects actions for defamation.
And that still stands. That statute still stands. It dates from 1946, but it's still very much part of our law.
It was, that was a judgment in a case brought by the South African Railways Company against a critic. And that's been reaffirmed not only in South Africa, but it's a celebrated judgment elsewhere in the world as well. But the important point there is that it's the wealth of the state being used against the subjects from which it derives that wealth. Now, what has happened in many cases, some of which I've been involved in, for example, there was a defamation claim brought against the newspaper by the former head of police, Beki Tele, who was bringing a defamation claim ostensibly in his personal capacity, but it was funded by the state. Now, it's constitutionally abhorrent for any public official to use public funds to vindicate personal interests.
Okay, so but that individual is a representative of the state. Now, I can see the state saying, yeah, we can, this is, you are our employee and we will defend your honor. But in the case of a victory, your honor, the monies that are paid to you should you win a financial settlement should go to the state, not to the individual who's been offended by an allegation of corruption, for example.
Yes, and it would be a cynical circumvention of the Spoorbond rule if the state was essentially pursuing defamation actions through its public officials, when the legal position is quite clearly that the state can't pursue defamation actions at all.
And in this case, ESCOM as a state-owned enterprise would be considered as the state?
Yes, without a doubt.
Ben Winks, thank you very much. Interesting conversation there. Independent legal consultant specializing in media law. So lots of fanfare, lots of razzmatazz, lots of noise around a statement today from ESCOM saying it and in the name of its chief executive. So assuming that the state-owned enterprise will fund the case against the Democratic Alliance and Natasha Mazzoni. it's something Ben Wing says actually can't happen in law. Going back to 1946, we have case law which establishes this as fact. Natasha Mazzoni saying she'll defend herself if this matter ever gets to court.
The Money Show.
The Money Show.
Kevin Twiname. How do I pronounce your name, Kevin?
It's Twynham, Bruce.
Twynham, you see, I knew I would get it right eventually. General Manager of Operations at the South African Banking Risk and Information Centre at SABRIC. It's all about the OR Tambo International heist yesterday. Speculation that anything between 20 and 24 million rands worth of stuff, could be cash, could be valuables, were stolen. Is there any clarity as to what that is, Kevin?
Good evening, Bruce. Thanks for having me. No, there isn't. We basically have what the media has. And it makes a lot of sense that that the police would remain mum for the time being while doing the investigation.
But we don't seem to be getting on top of audacious heists, and there are few heists as audacious as what seems to have happened at the airport yesterday.
Well, it's exactly that. The minds of the number of heists that have occurred since October of 2015, when we noted a steady increase in the number of incidents and cash losses on with regard to cash and transit matters.
Okay, I mean, something like two incidents every 3 days. It's the stuff that Hollywood movies are made of, except our script is getting a little bit tired and worn thin. Two out of every 3 days in South Africa, we are seeing heists of some description. It feels like a situation wildly out of control.
Well, that is absolutely the concern, is that the number of incidents that are occurring, and if one just takes into account cash losses, the question begs, where's all the cash going to?
Yeah, and how is it getting out of the country, or how is it getting back into the financial system? How concerned are you as SABRIC about the state of play right now?
Well, with regard to this particular incident, I mean, we've expressed our concern at the brazenness of these criminals, the manner in which they were able to get access to a secure area. And again, I reiterate that it reminds us of the number of incidents, and more particularly vehicle on road attacks of cash and transit vehicles, the way they attacked with in large groups, a syndicate up to 20 man strong, heavily armed, use explosives to access the vaults on the vehicles and then get away with millions, for that matter.
Kevin Twiname, deep concern. General Manager of Operations at SABRIC, the South African Banking Risk and Information Centre.
The Money Show. Bruce is on Twitter at Bruce Business.
I told you last night about the South Africans who paid a record amount for a racing pigeon. Talking to them in the next half hour about the process of buying a bird, one bird with wings and feet and a head, quite fast apparently, for 5 million rand. The guys were seated in a reception area at a hotel at Ghent in Belgium. I'm not sure why they had to be there if the bidding was happening online, but there they were moments after they outbid Chinese bidders for the same bird. Mark Kitchenbrand and Samuel Mbiza paid 5 million rand for a bird called Golden Prince. Talking to Mark Kitchenbrand just after sport at 20 to 7, but this was the reaction of Samuel Mbiza yesterday, immediately after they won a 5 million rand bid for a bird.
We are so happy. The Chinese gave us a headache. But now we have won. The most expensive bird is going to South. This is for South Africa.
Yeah.
And I believe that South Africa will be very happy, yeah, that we have made history in the pigeon sport.
You created a big history. Congratulations.
Thank you very much. Yeah.
Are you happy? I'm bewildered. I'm stunned. I'm amazed. Happy? Many other things. I don't know if I'm happy, but I'm interested. We'll talk to them just after sport at 20 to 7.
The Money Show.
The markets.
We just got an email from OR Tambo International Airport describing a sequence of events at the airport last night, and Eyewitness News no doubt will cover this in some detail. But there was a bucky, 1923 last night. It appeared to be police markings in the restricted access area near the North Gate 1, closely followed by a white Ford Focus. Both vehicles had sirens and blue lights activated. The vehicles were occupied by several armed men, several who were wearing police uniforms. They were asked to show their credentials. They produced firearms. They rounded up security staff and a security point. This is dramatic stuff. Eyewitness News, no doubt, all over the story. But extraordinary detail coming through on a statement from the airports company South Africa this evening. Gary Boyson is our market commentator tonight, director at Rand Swiss, on what was a slightly softer day for the JSE. We're just gradually seeing the value of the JSE being chipped away. 100 points here, 100 points there. Gradual erosion of value, Gary Boyson. It's a little bit depressing after the great January and first half of February that the markets enjoyed.
Yeah, there's no question that the markets are definitely on the back foot locally. And I think it's even more difficult for South African investors to, you know, stomach this when they look across at the US markets that are just absolutely pumping and firing on all cylinders.
And we got going in our favor as a slightly stronger currency, but it's cold comfort, I suspect, in the face of the S&P 500 hitting record after record, the Dow hitting record after record, and we are a good 10% away from our record levels, because so many of the shares that drove the market to 55,000 something when it was at record territory benefited from the weaker currency.
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of our market is obviously domiciled offshore, so the weaker currency did send our market flying. But again, you look at it, and perhaps it's not entirely fair. I mean, you look at some of the big heavyweight companies that track our index. I mean, if you look at something like Naspers, that's 20% of our top 40 index. So, you know, when Naspers comes under a little bit of pressure, it perhaps skews what's happening in the overall market. So you definitely do have some spots of light in the small and mid-cap space. But yeah, definitely the traditional, I suppose, blue chip industrial stocks like Naspers, the Mediclinics, the Aspens, and under enormous pressure in the last year, and definitely South African investors suffering.
They most certainly are. We've got banking shares coming under pressure today, retail shares also, connected partly, I suppose, to yesterday's disappointing growth number, but also perhaps more concerning for us as South Africans, indications that we have got better than expected jobs numbers coming out of the United States. The UK Chancellor, the Finance Minister, Philip Hammond, today talking about better growth prospects for the UK economy, and that is seeing that the value of those currencies perhaps could start recovering fairly soon.
Yeah, absolutely. So if you look at it, you know, while we you know, bemoan the rand hedge, the pressure the rand hedges have been under, if you look at the retail and the bank sector, they're almost directly linked to benefit for a stronger currency. So with, as you mentioned, those US economic numbers, that ADP number, which is the private payrolls number, coming in way ahead of expectations, and that serving to strengthen the dollar and in relative terms weaken the rand, and that definitely putting our banks and our retailers under pressure on the day.
I mean, what are the big trends that you're seeing in our market right now? I suppose tomorrow is quite a big day. We've got the huge Old Mutual, the huge Sanlam, and the huge First Rand all coming out with results, and they're going to give us probably a very good sense, a good barometer of what's going on in households, whether or not people are cashing in their investments, whether people are keeping up with their life insurance payments, and in the case of First Rand, if they're paying their debts or not.
Yeah, definitely. And I think we've already seen a lot of this, you know, with companies like AVI reporting. You're seeing that the story of the South African consumer being under pressure is still very much there. I mean, we are not out of the woods by a long way. And it's definitely going to be very, very interesting to see those results. What we are seeing, I mean, with the kind of companies that are reporting today, things like Ascendus, is that companies continue to try and focus on investments offshore, and unfortunately not investments locally, which, you know, itself becomes almost not a virtuous cycle, the opposite. Malevolent cycle, where investment is not flowing into South Africa, and that's not creating jobs, it's not improving, you know, the consumer situation locally. And again, we just see more and more money flowing out of South Africa and trying to find investment yield in, you know, countries like Romania, countries like Cyprus.
If only the money would remain here. The commodity prices, why are they taking a dive? I mean, gold all the way down to 1,208, platinum at 952, precious metal prices taking a big bath, and we've seen the resources index, the gold index, down quite sharply as a result.
Yeah, so in part, I think this has got to do with the slightly stronger dollar. Obviously, you know, you'd normally look at commodity prices in dollars, so a stronger dollar would mean commodity prices under pressure. But we also obviously got the first trade deficit from China in a long time as well. So we saw a massive beat also on Chinese import numbers compared to expectations, and exports not quite as robust. And that really speaks to the story that the Chinese economy is converting into a consumer-driven economy, which unfortunately is bad news for resources. But I think it is good news for the globe in general. As you have China, you know, sopping up some of that demand that perhaps isn't coming up from America in an environment where populism is rising and perhaps trade barriers are increasing as well. This is still a country that can play a very, very important role in global economic trade relations.
Gary Boyson, director at Rand Swiss, tonight's market commentator. Thanks for coming through for us, Gary, this evening. Gary Boyson, tonight's market commentator. Henry's comment on our SMS line this evening, talking about the pigeons. How big is pigeon racing? Ask Henry. Henry, I have no idea. And your suspicion fuels my suspicion, because if two guys can pay 5 million rand for a single racing pigeon, then I agree with you, Henry. Clearly, these guys can realize the 5 million rand. I'm not sure if it'll all come in winnings. I think the bird will be a little bit exhausted after what they have in mind for the bird. I wonder if he'll even be able to perk his wings up, Henry, after he's fertilized all the eggs they're going to want him to fertilize to get a return on that investment. But we're going to find out exactly what is in the pigeon business in about 10 minutes' time. Thanks, Henry.
The Money Show.
Earlier this evening on today's Fast Fact with MTM Business, I asked you, and I mentioned the fact that one of the world's most iconic capitalist images is a bronze sculpture of a bull on Wall Street. The world's third biggest asset managers installed a sculpture of its own in front of the bull. And what did they put there? And lots of you spend far too much time on the internet during the day, clearly. It's a female statue, not specific enough, a sculpture of a defiant woman. It'll be there for a month. A little girl. It's more than that. So a lot of you got the idea. It is International Women's Day, of course, and State Street Global Advisors, the world's third biggest asset manager, has installed a bronze statue of a defiant girl with her hands on her hips staring directly at the bull. It's beautiful. And what's so nice is it has attracted young girls to Wall Street to be photographed with the sculpture of the young girl, because there's so few of these things in the world. We don't pay tribute to kids nearly enough, and this is the future of the world, and this is a symbol of the future. And the sculpture is part of an International Women's Day campaign to get more women into boardrooms. Far too little representativity in boardrooms. And State Street plans to send a letter to 3,500 American companies on Tuesday, and that'll be next week, asking those companies to act and to appoint more women to boards. Has anybody ever done a study of how many women there are on boards of JSE-listed companies? I would argue there are probably more today than there were 10, and certainly more than there were 20 years ago. But what percentage of boardrooms have women sitting on those boards? I wonder. That's your MTN Fast Fact, of course. And we'll have more Fast Facts this week, and we'll culminate in the Brutal Biz Quiz on Friday. Of course, here's some more Fast Facts about MTN Business. MTN Business Cybersecurity, what they do is they give you a vulnerability assessment. So they have a look at your network security. They have a look at your email security. They'll check out your firewalls, and they'll probably stress test those and also make sure that your mobile device security is up to scratch. That's part of the service. To protect your business, visit mtnbusiness.com/z. If you know your Fast Facts, remember to join me with the Brutal Biz Quiz on a Friday night with MTN Business. And if you are the whiz of the biz quiz, I'll give you 2,000 rand in cash.
The Money Show on your number one news and talk station.
I told you yesterday about this incredible story. These two guys have spent 5 million rand, on a pigeon. That doesn't sound like 5 million bucks to me. Mark Kitchenbrand is the co-founder of Kitchenbrand's Loft. Seriously, you paid 5 million rand for a pigeon, which if it weighs 50 grams is an awful lot of rand per gram.
You're 100% right. And I think it was one of the best investments I could ever have made.
Oh, come on. Really, Mark?
I'm 100% correct.
Please tell me about this phenomenon of bird racing then that gives you the confidence to drop 5 million rand on flesh and bone and feathers.
Can I tell you firstly, just me and my partner, Samuel, what actually happens is, you know how men are, we want to win. And we will win at any cost. So firstly, we want the genetics. You know, the best birds in the world are the most expensive birds normally. And those are the birds that win the races. So we compete at the highest levels in Johannesburg. We compete at single bird lofts like the Million Dollar Race at Sun City. It used to be Sun City. It's now in the Vol Triangle. And we were very fortunate in 2011 to win the Million Dollar Race. Now, you know, you ask yourself, why so much money? You know, when you win $200,000 first prize, and the total purse is $1 million. So, you know, it's all about competing and then obviously winning and getting a return on investment. When you buy the world's most expensive pigeon, the obvious thing is that bird will be breeding, and we will put the best hens to him, and those babies and offspring will be made available on a platform worldwide for sale. So your return on investment on such a pigeon is not only the racing of the offspring, but obviously the selling of the offspring to various buyers all over the world.
Well, I would assume you're not going to let Golden Prince out of your sight. I mean, I know he's a homing pigeon and these things do come home, but if he gets a bit tired halfway home one day and sits down next to a hungry cat, the cat doesn't care how much he cost. The cat sees a meal. Will you let him out of your sight?
Now, come and tell you how it works now. Is that obviously when we race birds, we race them to our lofts and they get exposed to, you know, the elements out there, the hawks and everything else. But a pigeon like this that's been bought specifically for breeding will be kept in a breeding pen. And in this case, we're going to be keeping him in Belgium at the home of pigeons called Pieper. And this is the platform that we actually bought the bird on. They have a breeding stud. And he will be in his loft together with his hen individually so that he doesn't, you know, have competition. And he will breed for the rest of his life. So he's going to be kept in what we call a single pen with his hen breeding. So there are no risks of outside elements. Sure, a bird can die of a heart attack and these things happen. But generally we have vets. They are full-time vets. They have a whole crew of people looking after the birds. And we will then breed the offspring. The babies we will send back to South Africa. And then we will obviously cross those with the current genetic lines that we've got. Golden Prince will stay in Belgium and breed, and his offspring will be sold on Pieper, the platform that we actually bought on.
Well, what is it about his genetics? I mean, is he a proven racer that has given you a track record upon which to pay €360,000 for him?
If I can put it into context, Belgium is the biggest or the home of pigeons.
Oh.
And the best pigeons all generate or come out of Belgium. Over the last 20 years on the long distance, now long distance is anything from about 500 kilometers up to 1,100 kilometers. This pigeon, over the last 20 years, in three races, had the highest coefficient of any pigeon that raced. He is a superstar. He's a Usain Bolt, if I can put it in perspective. This bird just annihilated everything. And because of those results, and because of his grandfather, who was also a superstar, the genetic line is there. You know, it's like buying out of horse chestnut.
Yeah.
You know, you're buying...
I mean, I understand the genetics of it. Mark, can you... I mean, where are you based?
I'm based in Alberton in Johannesburg.
Okay. I want you in...
Our breeding study is also here.
I want you in studio, please, for more time. I want to understand the science of this bird racing business because it sounds fascinating.
Welcome.
I want to know where the money comes for prizes. I want to know the excitement and the hype and the thrill.
I just want to give you a
thrill.
Perspective.
Sure.
In China, you've got 1 million pigeon fanciers, about 10 million taking part on a weekly basis. They are betting, you're talking millions and millions of euros on a weekend on betting on these pigeons. So they create our industry. They basically buy on the Belgium sites. And that's why it was a blood nose for them when we beat them on the auction, because we typically took what they generally always take. They always buy the best.
Mark, it's...
So for South Africa and our country, it was unbelievable. And then, you know, we are looking, my partner specific... You know, he's looking to introduce the pigeons into the black communities. You know, we're looking to take kids off the streets, to introduce them to the sport. The opportunities are endless.
How can you call it a sport? The pigeons are the ones doing the exercise, Mark. I'm joking, of course. I understand.
They obviously are. But let me tell you now, you have to be seriously intellectual. Because remember something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're the vet, you're the trainer, you're the feed analyst, you're the breeder. These birds, we condition them. We give them carbo loading, protein loading. We get them 100% perfect for that race. If they're not perfect, they're not going to win.
Mark,
pretty intellectual.
I want you and Samuel Mbiza, please, in studio with me soon to talk about the science of pigeon racing. It's extraordinary to me. I can't wait to learn more about this. The most excited man in the country today, along with his good friend and business partner, Samuel Mbiza, is Mark Kitchenbrand, the co-founder of Kitchen Brand's Loft. It's a place where they keep pigeons.
Money Show. Bruce is on Twitter @BruceBusiness.
Well, it's happy birthday to the Kruger Rand. Happy 50th birthday to the Kruger Rand. Richard Collicott is the executive head of marketing at the Rand Refinery. Whose idea was the Kruger Rand, Richard?
Well, Bruce, firstly, thanks very much for having me on tonight. It's a great pleasure to speak to you. So the original idea of the Kruger Rand came from the Chamber of Mines in the late 1960s as a way to add value to South Africa's gold.
Okay, and the naming of the Kruger Rand was really interesting because it was going to be called something pretty lame, and then there was a competition, and a guy came up and said, well, the missing Kruger millions, there's a heritage element here, and the imagination of the world was captured.
Yeah, I think it was actually quite interesting because the Chamber originally came up with the idea of the name the Trojan, linked to being a troy ounce of gold.
Yeah.
And that was the name taken forward to Parliament in the late 60s for approval, and that was actually going to be the name of the coin until the then Prime Minister said, hold on a second, the Trojan is a brand of condom.
And really? Was Trojan around back then?
Yeah, it was. And so he said, we don't want such an important national symbol and such an important asset to be named after, with a share a name with the... with an American condom brand. So
how did BJ Forster know that, I wonder? But anyway,
I think he had informants.
Yeah, but he had sources. How many Kruger Rands have been minted to date?
Look, in terms of ounces of gold, we've minted and produced more than 53 million ounces of gold. And in terms of individual pieces, because we make different sizes, that's over 60 million pieces of Kruger Rands have been produced and sold in the last 50 years.
60 million. You make the blanks at the Rand Refinery, and you want to make sure that the weights are right, whether it's a one-tenth or a quarter or a half or a full-ounce Kruger Rand. Do you mint them there as well, or do they have to go somewhere else?
No, we don't mint them. We, in fact, manufacture the Kruger Rand in partnership with the South African Mint,
okay,
who's the only company that can make South African legal tender coins and currency. So we actually have a joint venture with the South African Mint through which we manufacture and sell the Kruger Rand. So we make the blanks in Germiston. We transport the blanks to the mint in Midrand, and then they return them to us, where we then package and sell them to local and international markets.
How many do you produce every single day?
That's a good question. At the moment, demand is really, really high. So we're running at about 10 to 15,000 pieces a day at the moment.
That's extraordinary. I mean, it's then a very successful export, because it is probably the world's most collected, I think, by a long way, the world's most collected gold coin.
Absolutely. I mean, it's an investment coin. So people who buy it are actually using it as an avenue for investing in gold. But, we exceed our competitors by a margin of almost two. And our closest competitors are the leading brand names like the American Eagle, Canadian Maple Leaf, and despite that strong competition over the last 50 years, we've outsold them by more than double or almost
Why?
Double.
What is it about the Kruger Rand, a face of a not particularly good-looking old man on a one-ounce gold coin? What makes him more popular than an American Golden Eagle or the Maple Leaf from Canada, which is essentially the same value? It's an ounce of gold, for goodness sake.
But Bruce, I think what we deliver is we deliver trust. So, with the liquidity and tradability, people know that when they buy a Kruger Rand, firstly, it's a valuable instrument, and secondly, it's highly liquid and highly recognized. So, you can walk to any shop or any merchant where they deal in gold coins and gold investment products, and you can sell it back at a fair price. Another big positive about the Kruger Rand is the fact that it's made from 22-karat gold. So it's a bit harder than a 24-karat coin. We add copper to make it a bit harder. And that means it's also more durable because you don't get scratches and scuffs and damage. So that ensures enhanced secondary tradability.
Richard Collicott, we must leave it there, but I thank you very much for coming through for us. Executive Head of Marketing at the Rand Refinery, the most popular gold coin in the world, is 50. It's all happening tonight, from Kruger Rands to cooing birds to 5 million rand payouts for birds. Here's the bird in question, by the way, and I want to get Mark Kitchenbrand and his mate Samuel Mbiza in there. Spent 5 million rand on Golden Prince, who's going to be living in captivity in Belgium. meeting ladies of pigeon persuasions who will be thrust upon him with alarming regularity so that they can extend the gene pool. And there's going to be a lot, feathers will fly, but I wonder if Golden Prince will ever fly himself again or whether he's consigned to some sort of life of pigeon obscurity, because he won a couple of races and his mum and dad were terribly good at this pigeon racing thing and his genes are going to be fed into the gene pool of pigeon racing. It sounds like a hell of an operation. But here's something else that's interesting. Out of the top five birds that were sold in Belgium yesterday, and one of you said, Belgium's got lots of statues. That's why they've got so many pigeons, because the pigeons need somewhere to sit, of course. But out of those top five sales yesterday, and Golden Prince was taken at the last minute away from Chinese bidders, but out of the top five, four were bought by Chinese buyers. The top bird, you say, the top price paid was by a South African. And there's a great sense of pride that they've managed to outbid the South Africans. But what's interesting, the second highest price was €126,000 of a bird called Devil Prince. Plus, Devil Prince's mum and dad, Super Gaby, the sire, and Robertina, the mother, the dam, they were sold each for around €75,000. So those genetics are clearly very important. We'll learn more about this interesting pastime. But yeah, Golden Prince, Devil Prince, Super Gaby, Robertina, and Prince Rudy. Oh, it has the makings of a biz quiz question there somewhere. Also, tonight I asked you about how many women there are on South African boards. This is International Women's Day, and today's MTN business fast fact was, what is the new sculpture that has been placed in front of the bull on Wall Street? And it is a defiant girl standing, staring down the bull. And the idea of this, the statue, the sculpture of the young girl, is to try and encourage more companies to put women on their boards. Rob Worthington-Smith is with Lehi Securities. And you guys have actually done the sums on how many women sit on the boards of the top 100 companies of the JSE, Rob.
Yes, that's correct, Bruce. We have.
Thanks for your call. Tell me.
Yeah, well, it's 18% this year, and there's less than 10% that are in executive capacity, and that 18% has not really changed over the last 5 years.
Now, that's so interesting, because you would think, anecdotally, you see lots of announcements of directors being appointed, that you would think that there's a greater propensity for boards to appoint women, but it hasn't changed in 5 years.
Not really, no.
Extraordinary, Rob. I mean, is there enough activism around that issue by, I don't know, the Business Women's Association, other associations who represent companies? Even the Institute of Directors must be concerned about this, because surely more balanced boards are more sensible from a governance perspective.
Yes, I imagine that is the case. I think probably more insightful perspective might come from our research economist, Wasim Token. I specialize more in looking at leadership maturity through the quality of the reporting in annual reports. But that would be a subject for another day.
Let us know, Rob. I mean, I would appreciate it. Thanks for your call this evening. Rob Worthington-Smith, be in touch, please, on the line just from Kenilworth at Lehi Securities. Just talking about board representation, I would have thought the number in South Africa would be higher than 18%, but maybe I'm naive when I think that we'd be north of 20. But yeah, interesting one. And also from McDonald this evening, who's very grumpy about the discussion that we had around Eskom. Eskom is suing the Democratic Alliance and also suing its spokesperson on public enterprises for defamation. And we had a lawyer on earlier on, and the lawyer was telling us all sorts of interesting things about the laws of South Africa, which state, it's 1946 case law, which says that the state can't use its financial muscle to prosecute its citizens in the case of where it has a difference of opinion when it comes to issues of defamation. So McDonald says, I think your legal commentator is a DA sympathizer who is talking hogwash about not having a right to defend their reputation. If they feel that they've been unjustifiably defamed, in his view, we have to rely on 1946 apartheid state ruling. That's pre-apartheid, McDonald. That's just a small detail. To allow opposition parties to defame our black executives in state-owned companies with impunity. First, I don't agree with him that Eskom should be regarded as the state, as it was incorporated as an independent company with limited liability in terms of the South African Companies Act. still owned 100% by the state, though, McDonald. Look, I think that's why it's an interesting case, and I think that's why it should go to court. I really do. I was talking to a retired politician just recently who says, when you sue somebody, when you take legal action, when you are being investigated for something, often it's quite a good idea to settle because you never know what your opposition knows. And when you go to court and you start allowing your dirty laundry to be aired, it's a very high-risk strategy. But this is one McDonald's, I hope, does go to court, because I would like to see a 2017, 18, 19 precedent set.
The Money Show. Business Unusual.
Business Unusual, Colin Cullis. It's like a Feedback Wednesday. In the last year or so, you've been telling us about Bitcoin and the blockchain. You've been telling us about Uber. You've been telling us about GoPro. I think it's time we revisited all of those tales, Mr. Cullis.
Indeed, and that there's not a world-changing, you know, disruptive business that I can bring to you every week. And that most of these businesses have quite significant developments in between when we've last chatted about them. So I've got three here. One of them falls into the category of, I really don't know. This is a lot of headwind coming for this company, and that's Uber. Then I've got GoPro, which had a real big fall, but some green shoots could be coming. Mm-hmm. And then there's Bitcoin, which we kind of looked at blockchain, of which Bitcoin was a part of it. And it's really looking like Bitcoin could really go big or go boom, and it'll probably happen in the next sort of 6 months before we get a real indicator of what this thing's going to do long term.
Okay, let's go to Uber.
So I've got nine facts, and you probably have to go online to read all nine that I've put together. And I said, if any one of these things affected a company with a valuation in just 8 years of $70 billion, they would overcome it. It's the combination of these nine things that have come ever closer to each other that I think may just make Uber as an amazing platform and definitely the way forward for how we will do personalized transport and taxi routing and everything else. But will they be the final victors? So the big one is really, do they have employees or do they have contractors? And there are so many court cases going or pending, both in the US and in Europe, that if it goes and says, nope, these are employees, then that massive valuation and the potential cost of the company, a company that is yet to turn a profit, is really going to change the way people perceive this and what potentially it could get if it goes and lists. Mm-hmm. And the amount of, you know, cover it's going to have to give to those thousands and thousands and thousands of drivers. Remember, Uber has done over 2 billion trips already. This is a big company. So that's a big one that's going to make or break them. Their CEO, and he has been pretty instrumental in just bulldozing his way through and to show that he wants to get this company working. Because there are others, his competitors who've tried to do the same thing. But recent video of him being engaged with a driver and one of
the... A really childish spat. And he's apologized, but the damage is done.
Exactly. So people just wonder if that's the case. And his reaction, or slow reaction, to a female engineer who wrote a blog post after having left the company to say sexual harassment is rife and the treatment and people's responses to it is very poor. So when a company has got that kind of stuff, and there were suggestions that there's a lot of infighting and, you know, you don't want to see a company that's constantly supposedly trying to innovate have those kinds of things that can really trip it up. And when it gets
big distractions, big taking your eye off the ball, and especially with concepts like Lyft, L-Y-F-T, for example, and others, taking them on head on. You can't mess around.
Well, as they keep saying, they're a software platform, and your software's as good as your engineers. And if you're going to start losing engineers because of the infighting or the way that they're treated, you're in for a rough ride. And the last one is the most recent one, and it was the fact that they had this service, this element called Grable. And for me, this is kind of the Volkswagen scandal for Uber. It was a particular way of engineering their software that they could identify law enforcement authorities who may want to bust Uber for operating in cities it wasn't permitted to use it. And it would use an amazingly complex check against credit card numbers and locations for where the rides were being hailed to ghost cars that they could never call. They've been using this since 2013, just 4 years into the company's establishment. They had already developed a means to basically circumvent the law. That asks questions about its ethics and its willingness to deal with challenges.
I've got a friend who's really an Uber hater, and I'm beginning to learn why. I'm going to go and research the rest of these facts online. Where are the facts?
Right up on the Cape Talk and 702 website. You'll see them all over there.
Good. I'm going to research that in more detail. Tell me about GoPro, because GoPro, from zero to hero and down to 50, maybe.
Yeah, so the cameras just reset what sportsmen, who were the original ones who took to this, could show of their exploits and where they had been. And they then added them to make them smaller, more robust. Effectively, you could shoot movies ready for the big screen, basically, with this really robust, really high quality stuff. And they just kept getting better. And the tail end of last year, the Hero 5 was due to be launched and big sales expected. And the Karma drone, you could now put a GoPro onto a drone, and the drones had been going big. So even better to get even more aerial footage of the amazing things they're doing. But they couldn't manufacture enough of their production issues with the Hero 5. So they were worried about getting it to the market and so lose out to competitors, you know, miss out on that Christmas season rush and you're in trouble. And the drones fell out of the air. Now, making drones is not easy. And here's a company who had been focusing on cameras and then tried to switch to making drones. And when they stopped working, people had very little respect for saying, oh, well, don't worry, you'll get better next time. They had to recall the drone. And that was the low point. Their share price, like their drones,
crashed.
But they picked themselves up. They cut jobs. They cut that entertainment division, which at one point was looking, this is interesting. It's not about the cameras anymore. It's about what you make with it. 22 years worth of YouTube footage apparently sits currently from GoPro footage that they've created. But they cut it. They said, listen, that's not our core business. Go back to building the cameras. Make them work. Get the production issue sorted. Curtail costs. And they're starting to get the production back again.
But they'll be okay.
They'll be okay. The biggest thing that they've got is Huawei, the massive phone manufacturer. Remember, we said no phones anymore, smart cameras.
Yeah.
They've developed software for taking that raw footage and turning it into something looking quite impressive. They've got about 20 million of this app currently out there for everybody. Huawei sold about 100 million phones last year. So getting those things natively onto those phones, the thing you use for editing all your videos is GoPro edit software. There's an opportunity for hosting that, selling you add-ons, or upgrading you to go and buy a new little add-on.
But being the innovator, being the disruptor is the most terrifying thing in the world, because no sooner do you disrupt and innovate than you are out disrupted, out maneuvered, and out innovated by the next pimply faced freckled teenager coming up 2 years behind you.
It sounds weird to say, but I think getting to the top is the easy part.
Yeah,
staying there is the real challenge for unusual businesses.
That is. And then what about Bitcoin? You say 6 months. The next 6 months are going to be pivotal for this one.
Absolutely. So the last time we chatted, it was all over the show. There were questions about how the code was working, where the price was, how many people were using it. But it steadily increased, partly because the mining operations have been hugely adopted by Chinese, who've seen that as a great opportunity for getting a return from this thing and creating an investment opportunity. A lot of people are buying into mining operations to get the return. So they have no need for the Bitcoins. They just want to see this as a mining operation. But also by Chinese and Japanese investors are seeing Bitcoin as a good place to go. In fact, March 2, Bitcoins became more valuable than gold. So that was the equivalent. That was the point at which it crossed.
It's so interesting. I mean, it's old school versus new school. And if you said to somebody, here's a Bitcoin or here is a Kruger Rand, I wonder how many people would choose which option. The store of value that you can hold in the palm of your hand, which can be taken away in a bank heist or can be taken away in a house robbery, or a Bitcoin which sits in the cloud that you never see and never touch. Well, what would people choose?
I wouldn't say just because you can hold a Kruger Rand that it could be stolen, and that you can't hold a Bitcoin that it can't also be stolen. They can be stolen, but it's a lot easier to get them back. You know,
yeah.
You can see where those people have stolen it in the heist. The big thing that's going to be changing them very, very recently, one, is the Chinese Central Bank may introduce its own. That could have a very negative effect for the actual Bitcoin price, but it'll also say to the world, Bitcoin or the cryptocurrencies are here to stay, in which case it might not be Bitcoin, but one of these things will become a
But it legitimizes, it gives Bitcoin a greater legitimacy in the world of the doubters, people who look at this thing and say, scam. If there are more cryptocurrencies, and you can bet your bottom Bitcoin, that if the Chinese do it, the Americans will do it, and European central banks will be forced to follow.
Indeed. And the final one happens around the 11th of March. The U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission will decide whether or not the Winklevoss twins, I don't know if you remember them from Facebook.
Yes, they were the guys who didn't invent Facebook and got paid off for not investing it.
Well, now they're about to have a little piece of Bitcoin, because they want to create an exchange-traded fund based on Bitcoin, effectively allowing people who have no interest in Bitcoin just being able to buy access and then trade off of the increasing rise of the coins, and it went through its highest rate ever just a couple of days ago, or its potential fail. And again, if that particular thing is approved, and there's a few people who would want to do that too, you can imagine a lot more money going into Bitcoin, which will see a massive spike in Bitcoin, which could be good news for everybody all around, or tears in 6 months when the thing crashes again because the Chinese government has decided, nope, you're not going to allow to use it.
Marvelous as always. Colin Cullis with Business Unusual Feedback Wednesday. Feedback on Uber. Oops, is about to crash and burn. GoPro, which nearly, very nearly did, but is gradually getting back to its core business. And Bitcoin, which faces potential huge global opposition. In a moment, The big five issues that Alta has raised with regards to the chairperson of SAA. Talk to Ben Taron from Alta in a moment. Yes.
The Money Show.
The Big Five.
Lots of legal issues on the show tonight, but yeah, filing court papers today to have the chairperson of SAA, Duduzile Sinthemieni, declared a delinquent director. Alta is taking the action. The Big Five reasons why Alta believes the chairperson of SAA should be declared a delinquent director. I mean, you talk about financial losses in your statement, Ben Taron, who's a portfolio director for transport at Alta. I mean, as chair, can she be held directly responsible? In title, at least, she's a non-executive director. Is it fair to put the losses on her?
Good evening, Bruce, and good evening, listeners. It is interesting that you say she's only an executive...
non-executive
chair. If only she behaved that way, the problems would be half immediately. Half the problem is that she acts as if she's actually running the company operationally. So that is part of the problem as well. And one of the charges we have against her is that she's saying illegally interfering with the board approved Emirates deal, because she gave a direct instruction to the CEO, Nico Besaidenhout, just when he was about to sign the deal with Emirates. She phoned him and said, no, you're not allowed to. And that means that she's dealing at the operating level, which she shouldn't be.
Okay, so the Emirates deal is one of the big five reasons. We've got BNP Capital, of course. This was a famous particular case where this entity that few people had heard of outside of SAA and BNP Capital and a few other well-placed organizations. And these guys were going to act as middlemen in a transaction to renew the fleet of SAA. And you argue there are numerous transgressions held within the BNP Capital scandal.
Absolutely. I mean, first of all, they were appointed illegally to do the debt consolidation. Then they moved on and said, okay, source funds, 15 billion rand for it. And the charge around there would have been 250 million rand. No work was done whatsoever. Alta stepped in and said, you cannot continue the relationship with this company because the financial, what is the FRP? The financial, the certificate that you need to operate as a financial organization. Mm-hmm. was taken back. And then they wanted to charge 49.9 million for a cancellation fee. So all round, this is just a smelly deal.
So BNP Capital, the Emirates deal, and also there was a deal with Airbus that went sour, and that's another issue you raise.
Absolutely. The board agreed that 10, and the listeners must understand that dealing in the aircraft business and buying and leasing them is a very complicated environment, and we're simplifying it for the sake of discussion. The board agreed that they made a decision that they will buy 10 aircraft. She then communicated to the Minister of Finance at the time and said the board only approved two. So she blatantly lied and blatantly misrepresented the board. And this is not only our words, the CIPC found her guilty, and she had to actually tell the Minister of Finance as well as the board that they found against her. So that process, the problem with the CIPC is obviously they can't declare her delinquent.
So
we are taking what they did, and we're taking this to the next step.
I mean, there's also an Ernst & Young report, an EY report, critical of procurement, and that report, you argue, was ignored. You filed court papers. I've seen the stamped papers. These are now documents. The charges are laid. Where do we go from here? Because one thing we know is that cases like this are glacial through the legal system. If we believe what was stated last year when the new board was appointed at SAA, Dudumieni is due to step down soon anyway. Is this just to ensure that happens, or are you going to seriously pursue this all the way through the legal system?
We want to pursue this all the way through the legal system. And the reason being is that if you look, and today is very interesting. The minister today fired the board of Praza.
This is the public enterprises minister, Lynn Brown, yeah?
No, not Lynn Brown, the minister of transport.
I beg your pardon. Sorry, Paul Peters, yeah?
If you look at SABC, Praza at the moment, and a variety of other boards, what you get in South Africa is you get the same people being moved around from one board to another, and the rot just continues. People make bad decisions, money gets siphoned off to companies that nobody's heard of. So what we need to do is to draw the line somewhere and say, this rot cannot continue. And what we've got a number of cases. Arthur's got a number of cases that we're investigating But Dudumeni was just because we were involved in the BNP capital deal, we've got a lot of information. It was the quickest and the better one just to finalize and submit papers. And the idea is that an example must be made once and for all. And we believe that this is absolutely groundbreaking because declaring somebody delinquent director is very, very scarce, and especially at the SOE level.
Absolutely. Ben Taron, thank you. Portfolio Director for Transport at Alta.
The Money Show. Shapeshifters.
I didn't know whether to bow or curtsy. I really didn't. But I'm willing to bet, and I don't normally take bets, that most middle-class South African households will have at least one Ina Parman product tucked away somewhere, whether it's at the back of the spice cupboard or whether it's where you keep your stocks or where you keep your sauces or your salad dressings. You will have something from Ina Parman. From coatings to dressings to herb mixes to stocks and sauces and seasonings, all of these sorts of things. Ina Parman has been gracing South African tables for 1982. That's a longer than many people have been alive. Ina Parman in studio with me this evening. Did you, I mean, are we going to have a cliched story about how you were motivated by your granny? Did that really happen? You look like it really happened.
My granny wasn't one of those nurturing, caring grannies. She was actually quite a grumpy old girl. But anyway, she allowed me to sit in the kitchen. And I learned to smell and to taste. And that is all you need in order to be able to cook or to understand food.
There's a beautiful film, Masala, what was it? An Indian family.
Yes, with a restaurant.
Yes. Mm-mm. What was the film? Help me, SMS 31702-31567. but it starts out with this little boy sitting in the kitchen learning from his mother, and he tastes everything. He sips the sauces. He feels the food, and that takes him through his life, and he becomes this cordon bleu chef with an Indian twist. Mm. You had that sort of experience.
Yeah, well, my youngest son Graham was in the business. I brought him up on experimental cooking, and he has a finely developed palate. What also inspired me is years ago when I traveled Europe on with a backpack and no money. For about 7 years. And it was teaching is the best training that you can get, because you learn to boil things down to absolute simplicity. If you write a recipe, the dumbest kid in 6D must be able to do it. And it was a fine training for me. I also learned what it is that where are the needs, what do people want. Then I was headhunted by the Technicon, where I trained home economics teachers, and that was also, I loved teaching. It's like gardening with people.
You see
the results. Yeah. You see them blossom.
Either they wither and die, or they blossom. Yes.
Yeah.
The movie, by the way, The 100-Foot Journey. Yes, the Helen Mirren movie, Cecilia, and others, The 100-Foot Journey. It was marvelous. Thank you, Nastasia Cook and others. Nastasia Cook, you, the story about food. Thank you very much. You taught the home economics. What was the attraction, though, of leaving education and going, again, cliched, into the garage? And starting, because you were teaching in your garage as well.
Yeah. No, my mother should actually be sitting here instead of me. My mother was a remarkable woman. She went into business.
Your dad died when you were young. You were 10.
Very 10, yeah. And she had to somehow keep the family going, me and my brother. And she used to come home with office stories. You know, I handled the bank manager like this, and I remember salespeople are terrible with admin, But if you look past the talk, they do bring their bacon home. But, you know, things that I just thought was stories, but it was the finest business education that anybody could have. Anyway, so eventually my mother said to me, jy is te slim om vir die government te werk.
You're too clever to work for the government. Yes.
Why don't you start your own business? Then she gave me 4,000 rand. And that's
what year was
1981.
4,000 rand, probably worth in the region of 50 or 60,000 rand.
Yeah, I was
going to
say about 40, 50.
Yeah.
Anyway, I fitted out the garage. My husband was extremely supportive. And I put my kids on their bikes and they put briefies in everybody's post boxes.
Where were you living?
In Constantia. In the lower part of Constantia, you know. God. And anyway, initially it was very hard, Bruce, I must admit. And eventually, Philippa Schaeffertz at that time was writing for the Cape Times, and she came to one of the lessons and fortunately loved it. So she wrote a glowing article about the lesson. And then slowly the clientele started building up. But what I didn't realize is that when people discover good recipes, they don't necessarily share it with other people. They keep it a hidden, dark secret. Exactly. They may tell their sister or their cousin.
When people die, people find their recipe books.
Anyway, eventually the word got out and the lessons became enormously popular. And
But you struggled to get your first recipe book published. People weren't interested. I suppose it was a different era when, you know, nowadays they're shelves full of recipe books. But you struggled with your first one.
I did, but it wasn't the only reason why we went ahead and got a loan on the house to publish the book was because I knew I had the clients who wanted to buy the book. And from the word go, our main focus has always been on the client. My son, Graham, who is now my boss and who is financially very literate, and it's a good combination because I always say I'm the heart of the business and he's the head of the business. And my passion has always been the food and the customers. Anyway, the cookery school grew and eventually it became so popular that I had 250 people on the waiting list and I had 40 people that I could seat. And I walked into the office at that stage. I could afford a part-time secretary. And I heard her saying, sorry, Mrs. Rupert, the class is full. And I thought, oh, God, no, please. Sometimes you make an exception. But anyway.
It was that Mrs. Rupert?
It was the Johann's wife. It wasn't the old Mrs. Rupert.
So not Anton's wife, but Johann's wife.
Yeah. But anyway, we all had an enormous lot of fun. But, of course, there's not an awful lot of money in running a cookery school because, you know, it's only as long as you're standing there teaching. Then Graham, who was doing a business degree, said to me, why don't we start a business? I said, are you mad? What am I going to do in a factory? I know nothing about it. He said, never mind, Ma. I can count and you can cook. We're a good combination. And we are a really good combination.
Ina Palmer is my guest this evening. She's the doyen of South African cookery. More with her in a moment as to how the business evolved from teaching to education to training to the factory, which churns out product. It employs something like 200 people nowadays. If you go to supermarket shelves, Ina Palmer's products are absolutely everywhere. More with her in just a moment.
The Money Show. Shape Shifters.
So from education to one day, her son Graham, who's training to be an auditor, says, I'm tired of fixing other people's messes. Let's start a business. And your husband faints, and when he comes round, says, you're going to do what? I'm talking to Ina Parman, by the way. She is the driving force. She is the heart of the business that is Ina Parman today. So this is what, 1990, you and Graham decided to go into business together. Now, that sounds like family suicide. It sounds like a recipe for disaster. I mean, you're good at recipes, but this is potentially a recipe for disaster.
Well, what can I say? I fortunately was still running the school. I was the food editor for Femina at that time, and I was writing for the Burger. So
you were busy.
I wish I had the energy today. Anyway, it that paid the wages of our first five employees and paid the rent.
What was the first product that you produced?
Seasoned sea salt.
Seasoned sea salt. Have you still got seasoned sea salt in the range?
Seasoned sea salt is still in the range. The reason for, you know, Bruce, my other weakness, strength, whatever it is that I'm one of these missionary health people, but I don't believe in freaky. I believe in balanced diet, varied. And in order to get my own children, when they were younger, to like vegetables, to eat salads, to eat whole wheat muffins, I remember Graham saying to me one day, Ma, we were in that bread baking seeds, bran, the whole gedoente. Ma, bread that you have to cut with an axe is too healthy. But anyway, the health thing has always. So seasoned sea salt. People put more salt on their food because they want flavor.
But if you create, if you put the flavor with the salt.
Put the flavor with the salt, they use less salt. That so that's where that came from.
So seasoned sea salt was the first. I mean, did you go tentatively into this business or did you go, right, we're going to go large? Did you go big from day one?
No. It was a very slow evolution. And obviously, in the beginning, when we started the factory, we made mistakes. Mm. And we wanted to squirrel help, but tall booty. There were times when, like our first export order to Australia, we had a batch of Cote-en-Cooke tomato sauce in big container, big excitement. We're conquering Australia. But a yeast infestation, when they opened the doors on the other side, the blood was running. And the cost of disposing of that, the loss of face with the customer, the whole gedoente.
But Australians are also very pedantic. I mean, if you come from an agricultural area and you go into Australia and they say, have you been to a farm? And they'll check the undersides of your shoes to see if there's any trace of manure, for example. If you start introducing fungi and bacteria into Australia, they tend to get a bit cross.
No, they do. But that motivated us to get a state-of-the-art quality control department and food technologists involved. And it's bad quality is just a luxury you can't afford.
But, I mean, have you ever got to the point in those early days where you thought this wasn't going to work, where actually you'd bitten off more than you could chew?
Graham he's an extremely determined character. And he, although my husband often felt, listen, enough is enough. The bank is on our back every minute of the day. Everything we owe is hocked. Do we have to live like this forever? And Graham said, just hang on. It will get better. And it was also at times, you're always balancing between different family members, but my gut feeling always told me that we're on the right road. People want to eat healthier food. They want to eat well. And we are doing the right thing. So just bite the bullet and go for it.
And the bank stayed away?
Just.
What about your relationship with supermarkets? Because one sees your product everywhere. Are supermarkets supportive of locally made, locally sourced products? Are they playing their part?
On the whole, they probably are. But
that's not convincing, though.
At the end of the day, the guy with the deepest pockets get the most shelf exposure. But Pick n Pay had a fantastic buyer. He's unfortunately retired now, Dave Smith, who gave us a chance. And one Christmas, one of the papers asked me to cook all the turkeys from the various supermarkets, which I duly agreed because I also wanted to know which is the best one. And the next day, on the front page of the paper, there I am behind the counter with four turkeys. And Dave Smith phones me. How dare you? I said, what are you talking about? He says, how dare you say the Woolworths turkey is better than Pick n Pay when you're doing business with Pick n Pay? I said, don't be silly, Dave. This has nothing to do. But of course, it was seen as that. And I was too naive to realize that. But the next time we went to see him, the argument went on, and eventually I said to him, look, Dave, nobody Fs with me. And I put the phone down. My husband was sitting opposite the desk, and he said to me, are you crazy? Don't you understand all our jobs are on the line here? We can't antagonize these people. You better phone Graham and tell him what you've done. So I phoned Graham. I'm sorry, Graham. I told Dave.
Yes, I know what you told him. Don't need to repeat it. Yes.
So he said, Ma, I've been wanting to do it for a year.
And how was Graham the next time you saw him?
Yeah, well, the relationship with David it was brilliant afterwards.
Because you stood your ground.
There was suddenly respect.
You stood your ground.
But I don't know if I'll have the guts today.
Don't say that. They'll know. Don't say that. Yeah. You'll tell them your secrets. Yeah. But what a lovely story. I mean, when you look back at 1990, you're celebrating your 20. You've had your 25th anniversary. Mm. You've lasted considerably longer than most startup enterprises ever hope to last today. How do you see the future of this business? I mean, the sad story, the Sally Williams story, for example, is a fabulous story of this woman who goes around, travels the world, gets a recipe, starts in her kitchen, fights off the bees, creates this great business, and it slips out of family control. Yeah. You hold 100% of this business, do you, as a family?
Yeah, no, we do. Obviously, one gets offers, but it's our passion, it's our life. And you can only eat three times a day. You can only sleep once a night.
No, I dispute that. You can eat more than three times a day. You have to practice, but it's possible. It's not comfortable always, but it's possible. Mm. But you want to retain it. You want to keep it private. You're not tempted to go and sell it to a Tiger Brands or a Premier Foods or one of these guys.
You know what they would do, Bruce? They would. Our workforce is not unionized. There's a very... there's a fantastic mood in our business. And if another big guy walks in, is he going to look after us? You know, he's not going to use the best olive oil. He's not going to nurture the staff along. He's not going to reply to Mrs. Jones, who complains actually quite unnecessarily. That TLC is not going to happen if we're not there.
It's the wonderful story of the empire being built by Graham and Ina Parman. Her name, however, is on the packages. South Africa's original Spice Girl, my producer tells me. I think that suits, and that suits quite nicely. Ina Parman, thank you so much for coming in and telling us the beautiful stories. Ina Parman,
thank you.
Our shapeshifter tonight.